Good evening, everybody. It's nice to be with you. My name is Padraig. I'm a friend of Emily's, and so I've been here a few times before to attend as well as to speak. So it is nice to be with you, and happy Lent. I know that some of you are going to be thinking about the Book of Ruth during Lent, and so I have 14 things about Ruth. That I thought I could. And they'll each take about 10 minutes. So, welcome to Ireland. So the first is that subjectivity matters. The Book of Ruth is a story about a widowed... I'm going to take these off. I can't see you, but it means that at least there's no fog between you and me. A widowed, displaced border crosser from a hated country nearby... maybe it's as far as from here to New Jersey. We're not talking about people crossing a continent. A widowed displaced border crosser crosses, and she is the one through whom the story of the law is interpreted. And so subjectivity matters. In the Feast of Shavuot and Pentecost, in Jewish services, read the giving of the law to Mount Moses on top of the mountain, and then they read this entire book alongside that. And so the idea of God, the law coming from on high, and the law coming across a border in the shape of a widow to displace border cross, female border crosser. These two things are not in competition with each other. They have to collaborate with each other. The second thing is that near neighbours can have long memories. That can be funny when it comes to sport, maybe, or a bit of banter. I'm from County Cork in Ireland, and I regularly say terrible things about people from County Limerick, which is just next door. In fact, when me and my partner are driving to County Cork, there's a little corner of Limerick you have to go through, and we have a competition who can hold our breath for the longest when we cross through. And it's dangerous when I'm driving, you know, so he does it. He's amazing at holding his breath. So Ruth is a Moabite, and between the Moabite and the Israelites, there was a long history as to who hated the other and why, and what was the justification for that. And there was all kinds of ways within which the stereotypes played out, some along gender lines, your women are loose, your men are brutal, or some along history lines, your people cursed the wells when we were thirsty, or your people killed us, you know, back and forth. And near neighbours can have long memories, and so much so that there's not only conflict, but then there's conflict about what the conflict's about. Mm-hmm. And that is a powerful thing. It isn't to say, well, it's just 50-50. It's not. Some of the things that were done were terrible and need to be uncovered and confessed. But it is to say that conflict is a conflicted thing, and memories can be a painful thing in there. Number three, I am going to race through these. You can have the notes if you like as well, if they'll make any sense to you. Ruth and Naomi, we read about this here. You know, Naomi has these two daughters, Orpah and Ruth, and she sends them back to their mothers after the sons have died. And I get the impression that Naomi was planning on dying before she got back to her homeland. Naomi wasn't very liked in her homeland because they had money enough to help, but they didn't help. They left. They skedaddled to Moabite territory, which is a complicated thing to do. And so that is a painful and difficult thing. And so Naomi was not going home to, hey, great, she's back. It's, hey, check it out. They had money, they upped and left, and they kept their property here, never helping locals. So she wasn't going back to expecting to be loved. And so when Ruth says, I'm going back with you, I can imagine Naomi was like, damn. And Ruth is essentially saying, I will keep you alive. And that is almost like a threat to somebody who didn't want to be kept alive. That's how I read it anyway. That's how I weigh into it. Naomi is an ethical businesswoman. You see here at the top when you turn the page over, you know, Naomi is saying, look, even if I had a husband tonight and I had sons, you'd have to wait for them to be old enough to give you sons. Basically, Naomi understood that in the context here, family and marriage was a business, and she had ethical obligations. It's why I think the Book of Ruth was written by a woman, because the characterization of women in it is women with multiple approaches to the whole story of the question of their life. They're not just typecast into one way. Mm-hmm. And Naomi is a businesswoman. Over and over again, Naomi has deep concern, A, about the welfare of Ruth, eventually, but B, about the reputation of the family business, which is the family name. And I think that's a really helpful thing to keep in mind with her. The backdrop to all of this is a profound knowledge, this is number five, a profound knowledge about what happens to women when they cross borders. What happens to people of all genders when they cross borders, but especially to people who are women, people who are perceived as women when they cross borders. When, in chapter two, you'll see as you read through, Ruth is out basically claiming social welfare to glean the edges of the fields that were left unharvested. She finds one field where the men were told by the field owner, leave her alone. What does that tell us? Where wasn't she left alone? This is nowhere near a pretty story. Number six is that social welfare matters. Gleaning the edges of a field was important. These were not nice American rectangular fields. These were something a little bit more like permaculture, with copses and dips and dells. So the edge, the unharvested places, were also places of where you had to take your safety into mind. But also, it was a place where people chose not to make money in those unharvested places for the benefit of people who needed to harvest there, widows and orphans usually. The question then as to, well, quite who is a widow? A widow of who and an orphan of what and for how long? Those questions came up. And you will often hear those within the question of social welfare today, of course, or whatever you call that, direct public provision, or you understand what I mean by social welfare. God is just a word, and a fairly uninteresting word in the book of Ruth. This is number seven. God is kind of in the prayer, you know, your people will be my people, your God will be my God. That's just a kind of an abstract thing. Somebody once said to me, oh, that's evidence that Ruth converted. Like, no, that's evidence that Ruth has guts. And she's just saying, look, everything, I'm with you, you know. And so God is just a word in the context of this text. This text isn't really interested in God as character and is profoundly interested in God as event. Event as manifested in the possibility of change in the face of a widowed, bordered, displaced, or widowed, displaced border crosser. Number eight, we're over halfway. Screw your pity, we want change. So Ruth is not looking for pity. Ruth is not looking to go, oh God, poor widow, God help her, let's look after her, she deserves our pity. Ruth knows, actually, she deserves social welfare. She deserves justice. She takes her marriage seriously. Other people didn't, because she was a Moabite, but she took her marriage seriously. And this, I think, is a really important thing to recognise in the context of this, that this is not a story of a people taking pity on Ruth. This is a story of Ruth taking her story seriously. And as a result of that, she asks for the community to pivot towards her. And that, I think, is a vital understanding when it comes to this. Number nine is closely related, which is that marriage has been a battleground for a long time. It was always in questions to do with theological reflections on equal marriage and marriage inclusion over the last decade. I was disappointed not to see more places use the Book of Ruth, because what you see is the battleground of marriage. Because there were laws that said, look, if you're married to a foreigner, that's well and good, unless the foreigner is from Limerick. And if they're from Limerick, or Moabite territory, if they're from there, well then, that's not a real marriage. And if it's not a real marriage, if you're dead, well then they can't get social welfare. Because if they get social welfare, they might come here. We don't want them coming here. And so you see the way within which the battleground of marriage has been, marriage as battleground has been around for thousands of years. And we should not be surprised in new ways when this is going to come back again, of course it will, but to know that in a certain sense there's nothing new about that, and that the text is profoundly aware of it, and the text demonstrates people who wouldn't take that bullshit. Number 10, fear begets fear. In chapter 4, Ruth really is in four acts. In chapter 4, there is this character called a redeeming kinsman. And that isn't that he needed, that Ruth needed to be redeemed. It's that the closest male relative of Ruth's dead husband should redeem the family reputation. So the family needed to be redeemed, not Ruth. There was nothing in her in need of redemption. But he doesn't like Moabites. And so his name is Poloni Aloni, which really translates as so-and-so, or what's-his-face, or whatever it is you call. Honestly, it's a bit of humour in the Bible, which is rare enough, so you might as well take it. And when he's told, look, you're the nearest redeeming kinsman, he's like, well, I'd like the land that comes with her, but if I marry her, her future half-children, her future children, which would be half my children, will be half foreign, and they will want to come and take my land as their inheritance. None of these people exist yet. So he's fantasizing a fearful future, projecting into that and acting impoverishedly in the imagination in the here and now. Where do we see that? Everywhere. In the human heart. A way of looking at causation into the future, projecting fear into the future, and allowing a fear that hasn't been embodied yet to justify an impoverished way of acting in the here and now. Fear begets fear. And this is a powerful dynamic that you see in the characterization here in the text. Number 11, we're nearly at the end. The text interprets the text. This is a really interesting text about change over and over again. We're used to, in situations where people will say, well, the Bible says all kinds of shit, you know, so therefore we don't really know what to do about how to interpret the Bible. What's interesting is that often an ethical standard about how to interpret the text is present in the text. Because technically, it wasn't possible for Ruth to have her marriage honoured. Technically, she should have married the closest redeeming kinsman, and the baby born, when the baby was born, should have been named as the son of her dead husband. None of those things happen. This text says, in the event of God, and God as event, not as character, in the event of God, the way we read the text that we thought we were interpreting changes. And this is a profound hermeneutic, to speak about it theologically, about how to hold the story of the text. Looking at the text through the interruption of crisis is nothing new. It's not a postmodern phenomenon. Allowing yourself to be displaced, to be undone, to be defamiliarized by the text is an old story. And in a way, the earthquake of the event of God is always the thing that calls for the people to read the text through a new lens. Number 12, people have wondered for centuries, and millennia really, what the experience between Ruth and Boaz in chapter 3 of this book is. Boaz is the fellow who owns the field, who said be nice to her. He's technically a redeeming kinsman, but not the closest. And Naomi says to her daughter-in-law, he'd be a nice redeeming kinsman for us, you know, that could be a nice situation. Go and uncover his feet while he's sleeping on the threshold floor. And unfortunately for your devout cousin, the word feet is a euphemism for penis. So you may not like that, but take it up with whoever wrote it. And so the question really is what happened? Did they have sex? Did they come close? Was she seducing him? Was she pimped out by Naomi? Was she being asked to reenact a national female stereotype of Moabite women? What is happening? What are the desperations that people do as border crossers? And what's interesting is that the commentaries for thousands of years on this have freaked out about the possibilities that might have been involved. All of them have freaked out. At no point does the Bible seem to be in any way bothered about the idea that, well, of course they had sex. Who cares? You know, what's happening is people's lives are at stake, and the way they read their text and the way they understand community. What are you caring about having sex on the threshing floor? You know, maybe it was a good place to have sex. And so it's a really interesting way within which the text is nowhere near as freaked out as the commentators on the text have often been. Number 13, ethical manipulation. In the bit when the two redeeming kinsmen are kind of playing off each other, so-and-so, and then Boaz, the nice fella, Boaz says, oh, I hear Naomi's getting rid of that piece of field that's been in the family. So-and-so goes, I want that piece of field. Boaz goes, oh, great, great, great. Yeah, fantastic. It's yours. You're the redeeming kinsman. Shame it comes with the foreigner. That's basically how he says it. And what you see is that he shames him in public about continuing his word or going back on his word. And he exposes fear as fear. And that's when so-and-so says, ah, here, listen, my future, as yet non-existent children, will be half foreign, and they will do things in the future that I can say that they're going to do. And so Boaz really manipulates him in public to hold him to a word, and then Boaz says, great, I'll do it. Fascinating. Number 14, Ruth is a judge. This text opened in the days that the judges judged. And this, I think, is a really important thing. She is not bringing pity. She is the event of God happening to the people, fully self-satisfied in herself. At no point does Ruth seem to question. Ruth has amazing self-determination, legal knowledge, and local interpretation. She is fascinating, and she does not waver in herself. And she displays an ethical movement toward community in her own imagination of community, and around her, the community, many of whom already agreed with her, pivoted towards her, which is a fascinating way of building solidarity. Number 15. Because why stop at 4? This is the last one. Fiction tells the truth. This book was probably written by a woman who had been in the early communities of people returning to Babylon, returning to Jerusalem after the Babylonian exile. It seems, I'm no Hebrew scholar, but Hebrew scholars say that some of the vernacular happening in it seems to echo some of the Hebrew language dynamics around that kind of time. And around that kind of time, there was Nehemiah, the patron saint of sectarianism, who was saying, if you came back with a half-foreign husband, or a foreign husband, or a foreign wife, or half-foreign children, the people had been in Babylon for 70 years. They were all foreign, for God's sake. He was saying, if you've come back with some foreign in your family, get rid of them. Get them out. Get a new one. And into this, some woman wrote a piece of fiction about a widowed, displaced border crosser. Fiction always tells the truth. And art tells the truth. This text is the demonstration of art having public voice into the event of a community asking itself who it is, and elevates the project of art as the possibility of the event of God also. 15 things. It's lovely to be with you. I'm so excited to hear about what happens. I'd love to hear from any of you as you read through the book over the few months. I've written some questions in that book that some of you might read. Glenn Jordan wrote The Real Brilliance. So honour him. His name is a blessing. So we're going to have a moment of silence now, and then somebody is going to do something clever that I've forgotten.
We share the sermon at St. Lydia's, and we'll hold just a moment of silence, and then when I ring the bell, you're invited to share stories or experiences sparked by the scripture or by Padraig's reflections. Two invitations about how we hold the space. First, we don't engage in crosstalk, either critiquing or praising what others have said, but simply sharing our own story or reflection. And second, if you tend to always jump in, maybe hold back and make space for others. And if you tend to hold back and not jump in and share, you're invited to step in and to share your experience. So we begin in silence.